Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Yeah, I'm back. This is Fran Lewis, and boy, do we have a great show for you. Fortunately, the snow is not coming. The sun is shining. It's freezing outside, but who cares? It's beautiful on the inside, and this is going to be fun. I have author A.J. Sandransky here, Forgiving Maximo Rothman. And I'm going to tell you just a drop about the book, and I'm not going to tell you much because you've got to read this to believe it. On a chilly autumn night in New York, the lives of two men born decades and continents apart collide when Max Redmond is found blunted in his Washington Heights apartment. Now, I know the area. I've been there. I went to fraternity parties in Washington Heights. So welcome, Alan. Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and I want to thank you for having me on your show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm really glad that I was sent the book because this is one book that everybody should read. So can you give listeners real fast a summary of the book and how you came to know the story?
Sure. In terms of the storyline, Max Redmond, who was born Max Rothman, is found bludgeoned in his apartment near death in Washington Heights, which is in Upper Manhattan, for those of us who aren't familiar with the geography. The local detective, Tolya Kurchenko, is assigned to the case, and he begins investigating the attack, which becomes eventually a murder because Mr. Redmond dies. The main suspect is a young Dominican boy. His name is Carlos, who is doing community service because he was a youthful offender. Kurchenko, he quickly concludes that the kid was not guilty. He's innocent. And he stumbles upon a box of diaries written by the victim over 4 decades in the old man's apartment as he's looking for evidence. He believes the diaries will lead him to the murderer, so he starts reading them. The diaries are written in 3 languages. So he has this girlfriend who is living. Girlfriend is Dominican as well, and she helps him to translate some of the diaries that are written in Spanish. Instead of determining who the murderer is, though, from the diaries, he comes to his own personal peace with issues in his own life, and at the same time, he does catch the murderer along the way. I came to write this book is that my uncle was a settler in a place called Sosua in the Dominican Republic. So I guess, you know, I should start by talking a little bit about that. In 1938, there was a conference call by President Roosevelt it was held in Avion, France, to discuss the so-called Jewish refugee problem from Germany at that time. And some 28 countries attended this conference, and only one country offered sizable possibilities for immigration, and that was the Dominican Republic. Now, why the Dominican Republic? Well, Rafael Trujillo, who was the then dictator of the Dominican Republic, was under a lot of international pressure from the United States and from Western Europe because he had massacred 26,000 Haitian refugees along the border a couple of years earlier, the border of Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And he was trying to curry favor with the United States after this occurred. In addition to which, though dark-skinned himself, he was a terrible racist. And he used to wear pancake makeup to cover his own dark skin. He thought by opening the country to immigration for up to 100,000 Jewish refugees, most of whom he wanted to be male, these refugees would intermarry with the local Dominican population, thereby lightening the color of the Dominican people. So while his reasoning was not altruistic, he did offer the opportunity for up to 100,000, initially 10,000, to come to the Dominican Republic. Unfortunately, the international Jewish leadership did not seize upon this opportunity because they were at that time much more interested in pushing and forcing the British to open up the gates of Palestine. They didn't want any sizable Jewish immigration to go anywhere but Palestine because they didn't want to lessen the Jewish claim for a state in Palestine. As a result of this, only 3 small groups of immigrants totaling 854 people went to the Dominican Republic and were settled in a place called Sosua, which I'll get back to momentarily. My aunt and uncle were among these settlers. So I knew this story, and most people, Jewish and Dominican and otherwise, had no idea of this story. It's not a well-known story from that period, but I knew the story of Sosua, and I wanted to write about it because mostly it's a story about tolerance, and it's a story about acceptance, and it's a very, very beautiful story. It's kind of the pilgrim story of the Holocaust. And at the same time, I had moved up to Washington Heights with my family in a couple of years earlier, in 2004, and I became fascinated by the neighborhood. It's an interesting neighborhood. It has several different communities in it, and it's one of these places where you have different groups of people living, but they have very little contact with each other. So that you have this very sizable, it's the largest Dominican immigrant community in the world, is here in Washington Heights. You have this old community of Jews, who most of whom came in, initially in the 1930s, who were German refugees. This neighborhood, excuse me, used to be referred to as Frankfurt on the Hudson. And then you had this third group of, in the neighborhood, which were Soviet-era Russian Jews who immigrated here in the 70s and 80s. And I wanted to examine how the neighborhood operated. So I decided that I wanted to write about both these things, and that if I could set a storyline in the present in Washington Heights, that I could bring the story back through the backstory to tell the story of Sosua. So that's how I came to write the book. And I also, as I wanted to represent all three communities, I decided initially when I started the book, started writing the first draft, to make the detective from the Russian community.
Well, my grandfather came from Russia, and my grandmother came from Poland. And, you know, I read so much of this, and all the stuff about Russia hit home. And my grandmother was in a concentration camp in Poland. And every time I read a book about the Holocaust or read a book about what happened, it hits home. It does. And there were very few people that she related her story to and told what happened, because it was horrible. And she told it to me one day. I don't know why. We were just sitting. We were very close. And I understood a lot of things that were happening to her or didn't happen to her because of it. How did you create Max Rothman or Max Redman? He's like two people, in a sense.
Okay, so that's an interesting story. Let me talk a little bit about that. I'm glad you asked me that. The initial, the genesis for Max Redman, Max Rothman, his name was Max. He was born Max Rothman. And why is it Max Redman? It's Max Redman because a lot of immigrants, when they come to this country, they anglicize their names, and I felt that was necessary to do in terms of his story. So Max Rothman is born in, is actually based on my uncle, whose name was Max Grunfeld. And there were a number of reasons why I didn't use the name Grunfeld. When Grunfeld is the Hungarian form of Greenfield, which was my mother's maiden name. And at one point, before I published the book, I didn't know whether or not I was going to publish under my name, Sidransky, or I was going to use Greenfield, because it's just easier, you know, on the eyes and the mouth and the ears. So in the end, we decided to use my name. But the other reason I chose Rothman was that my grandfather had a cousin who was last name Rothman, who had suffered terribly during the Holocaust, and he had no descendants. And part of what's behind this book, and a lot of certain parts of the book, is a memorialization of the many members of my family who died in the camps. And so I felt that since Uncle Julius never had anyone, and he lost his children and his wife in the camps, and I wanted to find some way to memorialize him, and I was very fond of him, so I decided to use Rothman instead of Grunfeld. So the original character of Max is based on my uncle. My uncle was the third of nine children, and he was married in an arranged marriage to this woman whose name was Helen Bokor, and their story is pretty accurately told in and adapted to the book up to a certain point. So what had happened with them is my uncle was, as I said, married off in an arranged marriage, and he came from a family that did not have a lot of financial means, but they were well-known scholars. So that, in those years, it was common for people who came with what was called yichus, which is kind of intellectual legacy, to be married to women from families where they had less yichus, but they had money. So my aunt's family was very wealthy, and his father-in-law bought my uncle I gave him a very large dowry, bought him a home and three businesses, including a store, a restaurant, and a hotel in a small city in eastern Slovakia. Mm. They were Hungarians, but in 1919, the area where they lived was turned over to Czechoslovakia. So the story is based on his experience of trying to escape from Europe. And then when they had gotten as far as Italy, they were in Genoa. And it was in May of 1940, the Germans and the Italians attacked France. And at that point, under Hitler's prodding, Mussolini issues an edict that mm. all non-Italian Jews have to leave the country or be interred in concentration camps.
Mm.
Now, my uncle was traveling with my aunt and also with his brother, another uncle of mine whose name was Louis, and this uncle's wife. They only had enough money for my Aunt Helen to go into hiding at that point. They had spent a lot of money trying to, you know, cross borders mm-hmm. and to get out of Europe. And so my Uncle Louis and his wife went back to Slovakia. They were never heard from again. We don't know what happened to them. So then apparently along the way, you know, this happened to Jews traveling in Europe at that
yeah.
time. You know, they would be arrested and executed. My uncle went into a concentration camp, Uncle Max, and Aunt Helen went into hiding. While in the concentration camp, representatives of the Dominican Republic Settlement Association, DORSA, were looking for people to go to the DR. And they showed up at this concentration camp, which was in Campania, and they said, if you will go to the DR, you know, we'll let you bring your entire family. We have no limitation on visa mm. numbers of visas. And my uncle needed dozens of visas because he was one of nine, and my aunt was one of 13. And he said, "Of course, that's it. We're gone." But he used to say, "We didn't know where the Dominican Republic was. We knew mm-hmm. where Cuba was, but we had no idea what or where the Dominican Republic mm-hmm. was. We just said yes, we'll go." So that's how they came to the DR. And the story of what happens to them in the DR is to some extent his story, and to some extent the story of other settlers who I've done research on, you know, and the community in general. The idea was that that these settlers would become proficient in farming, and the place was set up sort of like a moshav where in Israel, where there was each settler would have an individual plot, but they would market as a cooperative. And a result of this was actually that those who stayed after the war developed the most successful business that had ever existed on the island. They developed this dairy co-op, mm-hmm. which supplied butter, milk, cheese, yogurt, other dairy products, and surprisingly, salami to hotels all over the island, and other businesses as well. And today, when you go to the Dominican Republic, although it's no longer owned by the original settlers, all of whom, by the way, are now gone, they've all died, you can still buy Producto Sosua in the supermarket, and it's all over the country. And when my best friend is a Dominican guy who, you know, I met here up mm-hmm. in Washington Heights, and when I told him that my uncle had lived in Sosua, he said to me, "You know, they make very good salami." So, you know, it's a well-known place. So to the extent that they went to the Dominican Republic and they had these early experiences, it's my uncle's story. It's my uncle and aunt's story with respect to a lot of things, although they never went themselves to a homestead. They stayed in the village. The aspect of the story that deals with the couple going to live on this private farm came from study that I did on other settlers. I felt it was important in telling the story of Sosua that experience be examined in the retelling of the story. My aunt and uncle didn't split up in the story. You know, they Max and Helen split up at one point, although they come back, they get back together later in the story. They didn't split up, although my aunt did lose several pregnancies while they were in the Dominican Republic, and that was due to, you know, both her inability to carry a child and the level of medical care that was available to them mm-hmm. at that time in that place. So I hope I've answered that question for you.
You answered it and then some.
Thank you.
So he came to America afterwards, and we're going to bring it forward, and he has a son. And
right.
He and his son are estranged. And what was his reason for not believing in the Jewish faith after a while? He was very into the people in the Dominican community there. But he would not, he lost his faith and belief in God. And then it translated into the way he lived his life before the housekeeper walks in and finds him where she finds him. So what made him so angry at the world, and what caused him to turn his back on being Jewish?
You know, I'm glad you asked me that, because I think it's important to kind of understand the psychological effect of what happened to these people.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, my uncle went through periods of where he lost his faith and then came back to his faith.
Mm.
You know, my grandfather, who was my uncle's brother, my grandfather, with whom I was very, very close, he used to have this expression. He used to say, God gives us as much as we can bear.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Max's case, God gave Max a little more than he could take.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bad stuff happens to Max. I mean, you know, Max, my editor once said to me that, and he's edited three of my books already. He said to me that I am most natural, or the most natural voice I've ever displayed was as writing in the first person as Max. Because in certain respects, certain things that I've thought about are in Max's mind. So with that said, you know, what happens to Max? Max doesn't marry for love. You know, he marries because he's told by his father to marry. And I'm a huge romantic, so, you know, I can't help myself. I always believe that this is the thing we're always searching for, is this true and passionate love, and somehow it's going to win out. So he's married off to this woman who he doesn't love, and he gets the big dowry, and then basically everything that he was given in order to replace the fact that he didn't get to marry for love is taken away from him. He finds himself in a horrific position. So, you know, he goes to the Dominican Republic, and he's given this chance to start over again. And that in itself is a tremendous, you know, it's a tremendous boost to him. There's a portion of the story where you see him start to grow and start to develop, because for the first time in his life, he doesn't have a father or a father-in-law that's breathing down his neck. He starts to become his own man. But a series of events occur, and I don't want to ruin the story. That, you know, it's very serious stuff, and he starts to question, you know, his relationship to these ideas and these beliefs. And, you know, one of the big issues that I wanted to deal with in the overall story is this issue of identity. And I wanted to deal with it from both Max's perspective and from Tolia's perspective.
Yeah.
I believe, and this is one of the things I was trying to put forward, is that identity is not necessarily something you're born to, that there is a level of personal choice in identity, that you may be born Jewish, but you may decide to be something else, or you may not be born Jewish and may decide that you want to become Jewish, and which is also a big question that I wanted to deal with in the overall themes of the book, which is this question of who defines Jewishness. You know, Jewish law defines Jewish identity as being based in being born of a Jewish mother.
That's one
of Tolia's issues. Tolia's mother is not Jewish because her mother wasn't Jewish.
That's right.
So technically he's not Jewish. Yet Tolia has suffered through his entire childhood terrible stuff, including the loss of his twin brother, who, you know, because he's marked a Jew by the Soviet authorities and his family are marked as Jews and they're punished for their identity as Jews. So I wanted to examine this issue of identity and how one decides who they are. And I will go this far, which is to tell the readers who have not read the book that actually gets resolved in my new book, which is coming out in 2015, which is called Forgiving Mariela Camacho. So what happens with Max is that God just puts a little too much on that plate. He gives him too much to bear.
Yeah.
And he can't believe that if there is a God, that God could have done this to him. And there's a point in the book where he looks towards the horizon and he says, if you do this, I will know you don't exist. If you do this to me, I will know that you don't exist, because no God, no just God could do a thing like this. So he loses his faith. Does he lose his identity? his identity recedes into the background, and he grasps another identity, which is this Dominican identity, and he mm-hmm. becomes something else. He transforms himself, and he does that more for the sake of his sanity than anything else. And through this, he experiences a tremendous, beautiful love that, you know, again, I don't want to ruin the story.
No, don't,
what happens
yeah.
with that love. So what happens, and I do this early on in the book, is when his son, who is named after his twin brother, and the twin brother died in the camps,
mm-hmm.
when his son comes home and says, I've decided to become Baal Tshuva, which is the act of someone who is non-observant, returning to traditional observance, he looks at him and he says, I've given enough up to my God already.
Mm-hmm.
I've given enough up to the chimneys. I don't want to give you up too. And he can't accept that because his experience has taught him a certain thing. His experience has led him to a certain place. And he has invested a huge amount emotionally into this one child, for which to him is his rebirth. It changes, you know, the birth of this child, which is dealt with a little bit through some short diary entries, which you'll see a lot more mm-hmm. of in the next book.
Oh, good.
I'm very excited about it. We're planning to release it this summer. It's two books down. He realizes that he has this, this child, and the child changes everything for him. And in a way, he has a rebirth of the child. But when the child turns around and comes and says, "This is the life I want to lead. I want to go back to this thing that, you know, hurt you so badly," he can't mm-hmm. accept that, and drives a terrible wedge between him and this son, his only son. At the same time, his wife, Helen,
yeah.
is not unhappy about his return, the son's return to a Jewish life. So, you know, there's this big problem. And then it's not only that he becomes Jewish, he becomes involved with this rabbi, the daughter of a rabbi. He becomes involved and then marries the daughter of a very Orthodox rabbi. And he can't forgive what he views as the effect of what all of this did to him and his family and the people that he loved.
There's a huge wedge there. But there's a huge wedge between Toya and his father, too, before he died, too. So it's two of
right.
them facing this particular crisis, so that when Maria comes in and finds Max Rothman dead, that starts a whole chain of events to find out more about him. So he's Rachel is Shalom's wife. What did she think
right.
about her father-in-law? Because she's, you know, comes off as very bitter. She's definitely not, you know, my choice. But a lot of parents, my grandfather tried, but it didn't help, to match, and that's what they want you to marry, whomever. And a lot of times, I know the rabbi's son was, the rabbi was best friends of my grandfather. My grandfather had a lot of powerful friends. I think there were like over 300 rabbis that came to his funeral. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And the rabbi wanted to make a match with me and his son. I was religious, but not to that point. And it wasn't like I didn't like his son. He was very handsome, very nice. We got along very well. But I knew that I was not going to fit the type of personality or person that they wanted. But it was funny because he came up and he said, my father and mother made a match and I'm not marrying her. Definitely not. I cannot look at her. She's too whatever. And he managed to convince them not to have to marry her. I was surprised because knowing the rabbi and the Rebbetzin, this wasn't going to happen. And I looked at him and I go, you must be friends with me too long. What can I tell you? I said, if you're really unhappy, you need to... I mean, it was hilarious. He was gorgeous. He was so nice. He was my best friend, and he was helps me with my Hebrew in college. And we became like more like brother and sister. And, yeah, I said, Reuven, you got to tell them that you don't want to marry her because she's just not your type. And I know your mother's, you know, just playing on her. And, yeah, he got away with it. He married a girl that looked just like his mother. So I guess he
wow.
was happy.
Well, they say you marry either your mother or your father. But
no, not me.
But,
what can I say? My father, unfortunately, never met my husband. And my mother, adores him. She adored him. And he would, Jeff would walk in, and my mother would say, even with the Alzheimer's, oh, the good one's here, you could go. I go, yeah, okay, Mom, no problem. She would look at me and go, I don't know, whoever you are, whatever. I go, yeah. And she knew who I was. She was just being funny. So
yeah,
many people looked at Max one way, and he looked at the Dominican community as his community. So who was this young kid that came and helped him every single day and took care of him? And why did he do that?
Okay. So, all right. So, Carlos. Carlos represents it's a literary foil. And the situation with Carlos is that I needed a suspect. Okay?
Yeah.
So why is Carlos the perfect suspect? Okay. So Carlos is actually, he's a young boy. He's a youthful offender. And he has done, he's committed a crime. He's attempted to mug two old ladies on the street. And he doesn't get away with it because one of them, you know, takes a cane and smacks him in the head. And then, you know, they start screaming, the cops come. So he gets arrested and he's sentenced to do community service. So I created the name of an organization because I didn't want to use the actual local organization.
Yeah.
And I call it Hands Across Cultures. And he is sent to work for Max 2 days a week for 2 hours, 3 hours a day in the afternoon after school to help him. Because Max has a home health aide, Maria, but he also needs a little extra help. So what Carlos does is he helps him a little in the house. He helps him to shave. He takes him puts him in the wheelchair. Takes him out to the store to buy something. He takes him, and as it turns out, Max likes to go to the schoolyard and watch the kids play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that connects Carlos to Max quickly is that Max is open to actually going and watching the kids play basketball, and Max speaks Spanish. So he starts to build this connection with Max. Now, another major theme in this book, which we know there's a lot about fathers and sons, but it's also about fathering and parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And so Carlos doesn't have a father. And what happens is his father has abandoned him and his younger brother and his mother. And there was originally supposed to be another whole storyline here, which was Carlos's story, because what I wanted to do was compare and examine the experience of immigration among different groups. But my teachers at the beginning, I was taking a writing workshop at the time, they said, you're going to end up with War and Peace here. You got to cut this down. And so I took this out. And actually, a very big portion of that story, the ideas behind that story, appear in Mariela Camacho, because Mariela Camacho deals extensively with the Dominican immigrant experience.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is he starts to develop a relationship with Max, first based on trust. And he's never had a father, but Max is the first guy that he can talk to. And he says, during his interrogation, he says to Kuchenko and Gonzalez, he says, you know, he's a very cool guy, because he's the first man who ever asked me what I thought and what I felt about whatever it was I did, rather than telling me what I did wrong and how to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So he establishes this relationship with the old man. Now, what Kuchenko quickly realizes is if this guy has this kind of relationship with this old man, he's not going to beat him senseless. And
Did
he feel? So he says, no, slow down. And what I do is I bring in this little community drama, because living here, one of the things I've seen, and I am very involved in the community, I serve on the executive board of a local organization that fights childhood obesity in the Dominican community through Columbia Prez, and I've also served on the community relations board over at YU. So I've been involved with all sides of the community. I see that there is a problem in the community, and I wanted to deal with that a little bit. I wanted to bring that drama a little bit into the book, and I wanted to show how people use this as they use this as a political wedge. They use it to their own benefit. And I'll tell you, just as an aside, I recently was asked to contribute a story to a crime fiction anthology called The War Nation 5. And so I wrote a story starring Kuchenko and Gonzalez. And so, you know, for my readers who are, you know, dying for more of Krachenko, you can find this online. The name of the story is Mother Knows Best, and if you Google Mother Knows Best with my name, it'll come up. It's also going to, we're going to put it on a link on my website this week, I'm pretty sure. We're working on adding a page. But the reason I tell you this is because in this story, the two aunts of, it's the mother and the aunts, it's the mother of the head of the, there are these two politicos in Max Monroe, and there's a Jewish guy and a Dominican guy, and they're bitter enemies. But their one's mother and the other's aunt are best friends, and they appear in that short story. So you might find that interesting. So Carlos was conceived to represent this other storyline, and he was also used to propel the story forward because Krachenko realizes it's got to be someone else. He has to find the murderer. And it helps him to connect to, you know, helps him to connect to Max. You know, you got to remember with the cops, sometimes you got to give the cops a break. You know, first of all, they're like doctors. They're taught not to get involved in their individual cases. But at the same time, they're very overworked and they're very underappreciated, particularly in a place like Washington Heights.
Yeah, I would imagine.
So, you know, here's a murder, and they, yeah, I mean, it's absolutely the case. Here's a murder, and this cop has to find some way to get connected to this case, especially since he has a serious personal issue with people of traditional religious observance. And, you know, I've gotten taken to task for a lot of that by some Orthodox people who've read the book. But what I tell people is, you know, you got to understand. I mean, yeah, is he a bit of a bigot? Yeah, he's a bit of a bigot at the beginning of the book, but a novel requires a character arc. And by the end of the book, he's not. So you got to kind of accept what's at the beginning to understand what happens by the end with him. So, you know, I had to create Carlos to, in order to move the story along and to give the investigation some impetus. So, you know, that's why Carlos is there. That's the story with Carlos. And for, also for Max, you know, the other side of that coin is, you know, why would this old man, why would he, you know, develop this relationship so late in life with this young man? And the answer for that is just that Carlos, first of all, Carlos shares the same last name as a very other important character in the book. And for Max, it's like reflecting back on his life, and for a moment he remembers this perfect moment that he had. Mm-hmm. And that perfect moment came when he was in the DR, when he was a younger man, and he was in the Dominican Republic, and he was in his youth, and he had this perfect, perfect moment. And it helps him to connect back to a very happy time. And it lessens the bitterness of his life.
That was the sad part about it, is that basically when he was with Carlos, at least he had some joy in his life. And he felt that his present, that he was needed. Whereas with his son, he just felt that it didn't really matter. After a while, it was just, he would just see him was just sort of going through the motions. Even the scenes where he, you know, they're doing the funeral and whatever, and they're walking 20 or 30 blocks to the hospital, which is something I can identify with. And, but she has, they have this, on Saturday morning.
Me too, absolutely. You can't ride on Shabbos. You can't ride on a holiday. You know,
well,
I remember that very clearly.
You not only couldn't, but we lived in a building that had no elevators anyway. So it was six flights up to the third floor and six flights down. And walking on Saturday, we walked from Southern Boulevard to the Grand Concourse, one, a whole bunch of kids. And we, you know, went to one temple, and then we would go to Clinton Avenue, next temple. Then we walked to Pelham Park. We walked everywhere. And then everybody would go home for lunch, and then we would meet to go somewhere else, to a park or something. The boys would play ball, and the girls would gossip and laugh and carry on, whatever we did. But it was just fun, but you didn't realize that you were going into neighborhoods that were not exactly where you belong. But nobody really cared, because people would differently.
I don't think anybody cared in those days.
Nobody cared. Mm-hmm. Nobody cared. And you weren't worried. Everybody was the same.
I agree.
My father.
I'm sorry, it's not like that anymore.
Yeah, it's not. It's sad. I mean, there were stores on Southern Boulevard in Tremont. My dad didn't believe that we should have money. He must have known something that we didn't know. So he would tell different store owners, if my daughters come in, just give them what they want, and I'll pay for it later. And if I got all A's on my test, which, of course, there was no other grade that I was allowed, according to my mother, then I could buy any records that I wanted. I think the funny part was that there was a, I don't know if you remember, Colony shop on Southern Boulevard in Tremont was an exclusive clothing shop that my mother said one day, okay, you can go and get what you want, but she had already picked it out. So when I got there, I felt so grown up, but it really, that was living in, what can I say? So
yeah.
As the story progresses, we learn more about Shalom and Rachel, but they had a son who was autistic.
Right.
And that was interesting. And I think the son was more perceptive about people than he was, than they were. So why didn't Rachel want him around her father-in-law and Carlos? And those were the only two people, basically, that he responded to.
Okay, so I want to take a kind of circuitous route with this. First, I want to answer this directly, which is, okay. The reason she did not want him around them was that she did not want them influencing him in terms of his ritualistic and spiritual behavior in terms of being Jewish in any way. Mm-hmm. Now, what, you know, I have had over the years many, many experiences where I've had been in close contact for long periods of time in business, and usually in business, with people who are very Orthodox. And I mean very Orthodox. I'm not talking about, you know, people who are observant. I'm talking about Hasidim and people who are equivalent to Hasidim, although not Hasidim.
Yeah.
Now, in particular, with the women, and I don't want to use the word superstition, okay? They have certain beliefs. They believe that, for example, they believe that everything that happens is ordained by God, right down to getting a cold.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a cold from microbes. You get a cold because God wanted to have you a cold.
Okay.
And more than one of these, and particularly women, have said to me in the past, and I once, it was a Hebrew school teacher that my son had at a Reconstructionist synagogue, if you could imagine, who said to me that, you know, the relationship between God and Jewish people is like between a parent and a child. And if a child disobeys and breaks the rules, then a parent is going to punish that child. And they believe that everything, right down to having, you know, a sick child, is ordained by God. She lives a very pure, committed life. That's who she is. This is how she was raised. And it's not that she's stupid. It's that she's uneducated.
Yeah, she is.
And she lives this very, very from, very, 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 very traditional life, and she believes that she should be rewarded for that.
Mm.
And in her world, the reward that she would get is that she would have many children, and they would be healthy, and they would be chacham. They would be, you know, chachmot. They would be very, very smart. And she can't understand the resultant autism. It's not within her framework to understand how this could happen. She has to have some place to place the blame. So since she's observant, and yes, and Shalom is Baal Tshuva. I mean, Shalom is Baal Tshuva. She places the blame on her father-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And she believes, she concocts this in her mind, that she believes that if she can make him repent, if she can bring him back, get him to eat kosher food, observe the Sabbath, that somehow Baruch will improve. Because what she doesn't understand is the root to autism. Now I want to take a little bit of a sidestep, which is why autism?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is actually, the concept for this came from someone I saw on the street. Now, when we moved up to Washington Heights, I go to the gym early every morning. And on the way back from working out, which would be around 8 o'clock in the morning, virtually every day I would see this father and son and a very, 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 very religious guy. Now, the child had Down syndrome. And I used to ask myself the question, because I knew that this is, you know, this is their intellectual framework. This is the belief system. You know, how does this guy who's so observant, how does he reconcile having a child with a problem like Down syndrome with his belief system. You know, what is God, if he's observing everything, why is God punishing him? Why would God give him a child? Why would God give him a child like this? Why would he have to bear this? Why would God do this?
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw over the years, day after day, week after week, you could see this genuine affection. It's more than affection. The way that this father handled this child, the gentleness and kindness with which he handled this child, the love that was so evident, frankly, made me a better parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see them on the street, and I was just amazed by this, because this, to me, if it were me, I would be either questioning God or questioning the kid. I would never have personally been this, you know, there's a Dominican term, tranquilo. I wouldn't have been this calm about this. I wouldn't have accepted this in this way as a parent. And it made me a better parent. It made me stop more than once and listen to my child and what my child had to say before I responded. So I was very moved by this. So Shalom and Baruch are to an extent based on that relationship. There's this beautiful scene where they're walking down the street after Sabbath and he takes the boy's hand at the corner to lead him across the street. That's from these people. So why did I choose autism as opposed to mental retardation? Excuse me, I don't have to say that anymore. What do they call it now? Well, we'll just say Down syndrome, okay?
Yeah.
The reason I chose it was because it had more dramatic value, and I was also, sadly, I was acquainted with it because I have a nephew who has Asperger's syndrome. Signs of autism don't appear until about 3 years of age. And very often these children are precociously bright to the extent where they speak at a very young age, they start to read at a very young age, and all of a sudden they start to withdraw. And I wanted to increase the drama of the situation by having this occur at a point where she would have to, how was she going to deal with this? How was she going to, how was she going to cope with this problem? How was she going to internalize it? And she blames herself, you know, in some way initially, and she blames herself, but then she has to find a place to put the blame, so she blames her father-in-law. And, you know, the reason why they were able to handle him, whereas she wasn't, was because she was so uptight and so angry about what had happened and didn't know how to funnel that. To Max, whatever is the child is. He accepts the child for whoever he is, and he opens himself to the child. And in terms of Carlos, and, you know, people don't notice this, Carlos, and it's at the beginning of the book, Carlos has an autistic sibling. So he knows how to handle the kid. And so that's why they connect. And she doesn't, you know, and very sadly, she never really, in this book she doesn't. Later on in another part of the story when I write it, she will come more clearly learn to connect with this and deal with it. So that's how that came about. And again, you know, it's a lot of this has to do with how different people in different systems of thinking, how they handle the same situation.
Well, basically, I can say that each one of the acceptance is a really big thing in this book. Just being accepted for who you are, and she couldn't accept her son for who he is. And there are a lot of parents like that. And as an educator, I know, I see it. You know, when parents would walk in and your son is a wonderful person, so it takes him a little bit longer to catch on. So what? That's why I'm here. And that's why parents should not yell when a child makes a mistake. You explain to them what they did wrong and how to fix it, like, which is what Max did for Carlos, which is
right.
A good thing. I mean, I have teenage nephews, and they're a trip. And I explained to my brother, they're not going to always explain things to you properly. Sometimes they're going to use colorful language, and so what? They're not being disrespectful. That's just how they speak. And, you know, questioning God, I think sometimes I do, and I wonder why my sister died and what happened to her, and, you know, where is my best friend and partner in crime? And I'm just saying, I finally found out the situation and the circumstances, you know, the other day after 4 years, and you still look up and you go like, I just, you know, everybody says why, but I guess you're not supposed to. You're supposed to just accept it and move on and just remember the memories. I don't know. But let's get back to this detective. He was really Toya. I liked him.
Tango.
I liked him, and he's got a girlfriend, and they have an interesting relationship, too, that's sort of on and off also. And it becomes a strain because of his father, because he also never really got a chance to reconcile his relationship with his father because his father didn't want him to be a cop, correct? He wanted him to be something else.
That's right. He wanted him to be a mathematician.
Actually,
I think it was a physicist. Yeah, he was going to be a physicist. The father was a mathematician, yeah.
My mother,
they have a very interesting relationship.
Yeah.
The problem that exists between Toya and Karen is that she becomes pregnant, and she's delighted about it. And they've been together about a year, and he has not told her that he doesn't want children. Now, interestingly, one of the things that ended up on the cutting room floor, this was as a result of, you know, the first time out, when you publish a book the first time out, the publisher basically tells you what you're going to do. You don't have a lot of leverage. And the book was much longer, and he said a lot of this has to come out. One of the things that ended up, it was only a snippet, was that Toya had been married previously, and the marriage had broken up because he didn't want children. So he hasn't told Karen yet that he doesn't want children, and she's pregnant and delighted about it. And in the process of them reading through the diaries and her translating the story to him from the Spanish handwritten diary, she starts talking about how delighted she is that she's pregnant, but she says, I haven't heard a word out of you. And then he has to come clean. So it causes a tremendous amount of conflict between them. His issues are daddy issues. He sees himself. He looks in the mirror and he sees his father. I mean, that's true for most men. It's certainly true for me. We all have issues with our, you know, parents. There's been a lot written about the relationships between mothers and daughters. There's been much less written about the relationships between fathers and sons. And that was one of the things I wanted to do here. And you know, sadly, I had this experience a couple weeks ago. I went down to Maryland. I did a speaking event at a synagogue in suburban Baltimore, and it was through the men's club there. And there were like a couple hundred people there, and I'm like, how many of you guys have read my book? And two hands go up. I'm like, what's the problem with you guys? Why don't you read books? The truth is that in today's America, adult men don't read novels.
You are so
Most
right.
Most novels are therefore written for women. Okay, they read books on sports and politics and economics and business and how to. They don't read novels. So I'd like men to read novels, and I'd like men to read my novels. And I say in the in the acknowledgement that this is a book that's written for men, and men should read this because it's about fathers and sons and what we do to each other. So Toya has this huge issue because he was a child in Russia, and he suffered terribly because of his father's actions. And his father was a megalomaniac. His father was the leader of a refusenik organization. Refuseniks, for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the subject, were Jews during the Soviet period in Russia who refused permission to emigrate out of the country. And as a result of his experience with his father's larger-than-life guy, he doesn't want to turn into that. He doesn't want to do to a child what was done to him. You know, it's funny because when I meet people who are about to have children, I always tell them, you know, you're going to say that you're never going to do to your child what your parents did to you. I said, only are you going to do it, you're going to call them and ask them how. So, he has this fear, and that's why he doesn't want to be a parent. And what he learns from Max's experiences is that it's okay to forgive yourself. You know, it took us a long time to come up with the title for this book. If I told you that the original title was Unintended Consequences, would you believe it? And
it wouldn't
the
fit.
Publisher said,
it wouldn't fit.
Work.
The title was perfect.
Okay, so why forgiving? Because I believe that forgiveness and acceptance are the real underpinnings to successful relationships. That, you know, often when people get married, you know, older people, married people will tell them, you know, the basis of a good marriage is compromise. I don't believe that to be the truth. I think compromise promotes resentment. I think the basis of any good relationship, whether it's between parent and child, husband and wife, you know, friends, relatives, whatever, is forgiveness. That you have to forgive the other person when they can't be who you need them to be. And they need to forgive you when you're not who they need, you're not who they need you to be.
Mm.
And when you accept that, and you can give forgiveness for that, then I think you have a healthy relationship. And the problem was for Tolya that he never forgave his father
mm-hmm.
for who his father wasn't. And then Shalom brings him to that. You know, he goes a very long way through his learning about Max's life. And then he does this thing, Tolya, that you wouldn't expect him to do. He goes to see Shalom during the old man, while he's sitting Shiva for the old man. And he has this conversation, which is, you know, as I point out from Tolya's point of view in the book, it's kind of an odd conversation for me to be having with this guy. That's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
That's his internal. But they have a conversation about being only children and about being sons.
Mm-hmm.
And Shalom asks him if he has children, and he says no. And he says to him, perhaps, and he says, I don't know if I want them. And he says, perhaps your reticence about being a parent has more to do with the way that you were a son than the way your father was a father.
Mm.
And I think that that's an important thing to think about.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, he has a lot of daddy issues, but I will tell you, and you'll see this in the next book, he's a natural at being a father. And in this book, his partner, Pete, points that out to him. He says, Tim, what are you so worried about? You should see, do you ever pay attention to yourself when you're with other people's children? You should see how natural you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I have two more questions
before we
end, but let me just remind everybody. Next week, I'm taking off, people, because I should. I have one show on Tuesday on a different network, and if you'd like to join us for that show, I will tell you what it is because your writing might fit in. It's called Let's Write, and it's not about a book. It's about the art of writing, how you write crime. I've got Charles Schulzberg, who wrote The True Story of the John List Murders, and I've got Stephen Shukas that wrote Poisoned about Herman Billick being wrongly accused of killing a whole family. And it's about how to write crime, true crime or fictional crime. And basis of the show is at 4 o'clock. It's on Red River. It's a different network. And I do this on the fourth Tuesday of the month. And it teaches listeners how to write a novel, the craft itself. And I chose this because I'm very interested because my next book, number 13, when I write it, is going to be based on real-life events. And when you're writing about something that really happened, but you're fictionalizing it, I want to learn how to write it so that I don't get in trouble and what I can do and what I can't do. But I am very proud to say, in memory of my mother, and I have to contact my publisher after my extraction this afternoon, my next book, The Vanishing Mind of Ruth Swerdloff, in her own words, an Alzheimer's sufferer's journal, should be out by the end of the month. And I am totally honored that Dennis Palumbo, New York Times bestselling author Carlin Eggers, New York Times bestselling author Alan Topol, and several others read the book and gave me blurbs for the front cover and said it was good. And that is more than, it was like the unbelievable, like the sky opened up and my sister brought the sunshine back out. So I was excited.
Congratulations.
On February, now if I can get a traditional publisher for the next one, that'll be even better. February 5th, I have Harvey Stelman, Eyes of the Emerald. It's also based on a true story about the first generation young girl to graduate high school and how this young Jewish girl falls for a Chinese American. It's interesting. And February 12th, it's tentative. The publisher of Incantito Publishing, Peter Miller, will be there on how to submit a query and his publishing company. So that should be interesting. Then I'm taking off time for other reasons. And the next show will be March 26th with best-selling author Alan Topol, and the Washington lawyer. And, yeah, people, I'm getting quoted on the front cover. Ha-ha, how cool is that? I just got a thing from his publisher. It's little things that make Fran happy, not much. But I have one last question. If Max was not killed, this is a hard one. This is where my creative brain goes in. If Max had lived, would he have reconciled with Shalom, and what would have made him happy? How, and what about Toyev? If his father was alive and he had given one more chance, do you think they would? He would have asked, told him he forgave him.
Yes and yes. In terms of Shalom and Max, I believe that the way it's presented at the end of the story is that they're in this sort of discussion. And they're both coming to a point where they can agree to disagree. That's kind of the impetus. It's one of the impetuses for what Rachel does, is that she goes there to try to, you know, get him to pray daily, because she thinks that Shalom is getting him to become Baal Tshuva. But the truth is that he's an old man, he's a very old man, and he's heading towards the end of his life, and he and his son are trying to just, you know, work out some sort of livable arrangement. So I believe that they would have accepted each other at that point, and they would have agreed to disagree. In terms of Tolya, I think that he regrets, and he says this. I mean, he says it in the first couple of pages. He says, "I only wish I had had time to get to the hospital before my father died." He believes that his father wanted nothing to do with him. And it's sort of his own stubbornness is, you know, also a factor there, in that he didn't, he didn't make more of an effort to reconcile. But he blames his father for a lot of things, and it's very, very difficult for him. I think given a chance, knowing what he knows at the end of the book, I think, yes, had he had the chance, he would have done it. And, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, and it's not exactly the same, but my dad died in 2002, and unfortunately he was in Florida when he died. Mm. And it was a very, very ugly situation with his health. And I very clearly remember the last conversation I had with him, which I didn't expect to be the last conversation. And my regret is that, not so much that I wasn't there, but that I didn't speak to him one more time. We always wish that there was this one last moment that we could have. You know, some time ago I saw this thing on Facebook. It said if you could have 1 hour to spend with any person alive or dead.
Yeah,
history,
I wrote something.
You know, I put my father. That's the person that I would want. And I'm going to choke up.
Yeah.
You know, that's the person that I would want to spend one more hour with, you know.
I wrote my sister.
We need to learn to be a lot more forgiving.
Yeah.
And to pay attention. You know, I always say about parenting is it's about listening, not telling. And
yeah.
So that's sort of about being someone's child is the same thing. I think in life it's about listening, not telling. It's about listening to what other people are trying to tell you and then hearing them. You know, and when you do that, I think you're farther down the road.
There's a lot of people that hear what they want to hear, and then when you're giving them the answer, even the answer that they want to hear, even the right answer that you know that they're not processing it because they already have it formulated in their mind, oh, this is what you're going to say, so I don't even hear you, which is even worse.
That's
and
right.
As an educator, I try to explain, and I was the dean, to the kids, you need to listen to what the adult is saying. We need to listen to what you are saying, and you need to process it both ways, and then maybe you won't get in trouble. But what gets me is that, you know, a lot of people forgive. The trick is to forget and not bring it up again.
That's true.
And that
that's
is
true.
Probably the hardest. So before we end, what's next? Where can people read this book? And speaking of the fact that you said it's for men, my brother-in-law wants it, so I guess I'm going to have to give it up because he wants it, and he's probably one of the only males in my family that reads and takes all my books after I'm done. And he comes to visit, and I have to literally hide stuff, literally have to hide it, because he'll say, I want that one, I want this one. I go, but I have to interview the author, and I don't give up the book until I have to have the book in front of me in case I need it. So growing up in the Bronx is definitely me, and going to Washington Heights, which is where I had my very first fraternity party, and I was the vice president of the house plan that set it up, to get to the fraternity party to find out that the guy in charge never told the brothers that we were coming, and that was hilarious because they were all in their underwear, and they decided when they saw 30 girls and every sister showed up from the house plan, they decided that we were cute enough to have the party. And I was like, oh, God, this is my first shot at being vice president of a very, very snobby, and I'm not snobby, house plan. And I'm going like, they set me up. Okay, this is not good. And it was hilarious, but it was in Washington Heights. So what's next, and where can readers learn more about you?
Well, okay, first of all, you can learn a little bit more about me on my website, ajsadransky.com. My books are available on Amazon, iTunes, and Barnes & Noble. You can get it in electronic or printed versions. What's next is that I have the next book in this series, which I hope will be a five-book series eventually, called Forgiving Mariela Camacho, at least that's the working title. Should be coming out sometime in the summer. We're shooting for July of 2015.
Oh, good. Oh,
you can also, as I mentioned earlier, you know, if you give it a few days, we're getting a page up on my site where you can read some short stories. I work as I've had a very, very interesting life. I've done a lot of different things, and now I am a writer and I work as a writer. I write restaurant reviews. I write for something called Hashtag News, which is it appears on YouTube daily. It's Hashtag News Daily. Is the how you would search for it, no breaks, and that's a political satire. We do 2 to 3 minutes of political satire every day. So I'm doing everything I can. You know, I'm working on a couple of scripts, and I'm doing everything I can to be successful as a writer. The way that your listeners can help me is to buy my book, read my book, tell their friends about my book, invite me to come to your synagogues and community centers to speak about my book, and books, and don't ever lend my book to anyone. Because
well, then my brother, then I have to tell my brother he has to go to get it. He has to get his own, then, and he can't have it. There are synagogues up in Westchester. You got
to,
you know, seek them out. There are some really nice synagogues.
I know. I've been doing that. I can't thank you enough for inviting me onto your show.
This has been fun, and just make sure that I get the next book. Because by July I should have the other 50 read. And knowing when I get it, I'll probably just, you know, read it anyway, because that's just me. And when it has to do with certain topics, it automatically moves to the top of my list. What can I say? So I've got to find out what happened. I'm going to end the show. I don't think I'll lose you. If I do, is that the number, that number that's on the screen?
Well, I'm assuming, yeah. That's my landline, yeah.
Okay.
If not, I'll send you back an email with the phone number if we...